order. And colleagues, it's nice to see you again after a good weekend. And those of you in the audience, welcome. So with that, Jim, do you want to introduce us to what we're up to today?
We're going to be having a presentation by Christine Till from OUS on the PASS system. I'll turn it over to Christine.
Christine, thank you for being here.
Thank you very much, Representative Backlund, members of the committee. I'd like to introduce the Chancellor of the Oregon University System, Richard Jarvis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, Richard Jarvis, Chancellor of the Oregon University System. And just an opportunity to say a word of introduction on the subject of the alignment of K-12 standards and college-university admissions and placement. It's no exaggeration for me to say to you that the results you're going to hear today are probably the best news I've received in my time this year as Chancellor of our system, and indeed news that is national news within higher education. As you know, within higher education, there's enormous concern about the extensive remediation and developmental work that takes place at our colleges and universities. It affects greatly our ability to retain students and for students to succeed through the critical freshman year. And that becomes all the more important when we're struggling to maintain access at a time of declining state resources. The key, then, to reducing the need for remediation, to increasing retention, and to maintaining access becomes better preparation of those students working towards our colleges and universities through the high schools of our state. And the key to that better preparation is timely intervention, discovering what it is that our students need to know at a time when we can do something about that and help them to become better prepared. So the work that you're going to hear today is of enormous importance to those of us in the university system, anxious to improve the performance of our students on the university campus, to improve our own retention and performance standards, and to deliver to you a better use of the public dollars that you invest in our system. So with that introduction, let me pass back to Christine.
Thank you, Chancellor Jarvis. Representative Backlund, members of the committee, I have provided you with three documents as reference for my presentation today. I will not be using the rather thick document draft of the research that Chancellor Jarvis referred to. I will be speaking from the document overview of the proficiency-based admission standards system, and you also have a set of slides that I will be doing as well. I'd like to take just a few minutes and talk about the partnership that the Oregon University System has formed with K-12 and how PASS came about. Just a few minutes to do that, and then I'd like to go right into the results of the recent study that we have just completed that gives us an indication of how student performance on the current K-12 standards that are in place, how that results in better college preparation. First of all, a few basic primer questions. What is PASS? PASS, very simply put, is a set of standards that connect with K-12. Those standards are in six areas, and they define the knowledge and skills that students need to be successful in higher education. They do link directly to Oregon's K-12 standards and assessments. I have provided you with an attachment in your packet that attachment B describes the PASS standards and describes how right now OUS and your public universities have an optional policy in place that allows students to use PASS standards and demonstration of proficiency in those standards for seat time requirements. But let me go back to why PASS was developed in the first place. Attachment C in your documents begins with, yes, 10 years ago, actually 11 years ago. We're now in our second decade of school reform. This journey began in 1992. And in this chronology, you have listed the legislative actions that have taken place and so on to connect K-12 with higher education. PASS was developed in a partnership with the Oregon University System, with the Oregon Department of Education and schools around the state. And basically, here's what we did. We aligned standards. And by that, we mean that student standards, that the standards students were working toward in high school would directly connect to college admission. We aligned assessments, meaning that the state assessments that students had to complete in high school would be aligned with college admission. We created an alternative assessment method for students, and throughout this journey of 11 years, we have also been endlessly reviewing student work to get a better sense of the types of performance that Oregon students demonstrate on standards that would directly relate to their success in college. To give you an example of what we mean by aligned standards, if you'd look at the slide on page 4, this is what it means to have aligned standards and benchmarks in place. The student begins at grade 3, and I won't go through this in great detail, but it gives you a sense, I think, of when a student very early on learns fundamentals of geometry in third grade, from sorting, classifying, and describing shapes all the way through connected benchmarks, building on that initial learning toward college admission. PASS was built with the collaboration, in collaboration with teachers, high school teachers, college faculty, and community college faculty from throughout the state of Oregon. There you see a map that indicates the number of schools and districts involved. 82 schools from 55 districts, registering, enrolling 82,000 of Oregon students, which represents 54% of all of Oregon high school students. PASS was developed with grant funding from a number from federal and private sources, and about half of those grant funds went directly to schools over the last 10 years in the form of teacher professional development, training, and the development of materials. As we are in our 11th year, how have aligned standards helped Oregon students? Well, first of all, the Oregon standards are comprehensive and rigorous. That's one thing we've learned. If we were going to use these standards for college admission, we wanted to be assured that the standards were, in fact, rigorous, that they were not minimum competency level. We have learned that they are not minimum competency level, but far from that. The College Board and American College Testing over the last year have both provided us with studies and analyses of the Oregon content standards at the 10th grade benchmark. And what they found was that the content of the Oregon standards aligns with the type of knowledge and skills that they measure in their college test, and that also would give an indication of students' preparedness for college. As an example, on slide 7, students, as they go through the system, the illustration there being that students gain more and more knowledge and skills because the standards are aligned, because the content has been meticulously analyzed over several years, resulting in a system in Oregon then that connects benchmarks all along the way from third grade through the transition to college. Now, why is that important? Well, we recently conducted a study, and we realized that, and I'll be sharing those results with you in a moment, but one of the things we realized is that the earlier a student knows their level of proficiency, they can plan and do something about that toward their post-secondary goals and dreams. As you look at that slide, you see, for example, there are three measures that are listed there that we measured in the study called the first year. First of all is the time to prepare. Oregon standards measure student performance at the 10th grade benchmark. That 10th grade benchmark gives students two more years to prepare for two or four-year institutions. The typical national assessments that you are familiar with that are often required as part of a college application, the SAT and the ACT scores, occur one half to 1 year prior. The final high school GPA occurs at the end of high school. So clearly, just by the way the system is designed, the Oregon 10th grade benchmarks provide information 2 years earlier. Why is this important for Oregon? Well, a surprisingly large number of Oregon students actually do go on to 2- and 4-year institutions by January after their high school graduation. OUS conducts a study every other year called Where Have All the Oregon Graduates Gone? To see where students actually, what kinds of plans they actually do pursue after high school graduation. And here's what we've learned. 75% of our students by January after high school graduation are enrolled in 2- or 4-year institutions. This compares with the national average at 63%.
Excuse me, Christine.
Yes.
Do you have any reason, or do you know why that is? The Oregon has such a relatively high number of our students attending college. That's very impressive.
That's a good question, Representative Backlund. Part of it, I would think, is that we have a large public university system and community college system that would support students, and that does quite. We do quite a bit of outreach in terms of having students enroll. I defer to Chancellor Jarvis or my colleague David McDonald, Director of Enrollment Services, as to their thinking on that question.
Chair Backlund, members of the committee, for the record, David McDonald, Director of Enrollment and Student Services in the Chancellor's Office. Indeed, part of it is the outreach and the awareness that students gain. Part of it also is an artifact of the dropout rates in the state, where we do have a fairly high high school dropout rate, which typically occurs at the very, very early stages of high school. So those students who are not academically prepared or socially motivated tend to exclude themselves from that whole graduating class pool from which a 75% is drawn. But certainly some of it is the increased awareness by Oregonians that higher education clearly is part of what they need to have to be prepared for the next steps in their careers.
Regarding numbers of students going on directly to 2- and 4-year institutions, I think it's interesting to note the 25% who do not go on. And what the Oregon University System study was able to discover is that many of those students do not go on because of financial need. And should that money be available, they indicate a likelihood that they would pursue a college education if resources were available. I've provided in your packet a list of schools that participated in past development, and you can see, it's attachment D, you can see there are quite a number of high schools that were involved. It was really the most sensible way to build the system because we were building on standards that teachers were already teaching in their classrooms. To the study, well, it's been 11 years. And up until now, we have not had data that indicate whether or not students meeting standards at the 10th grade benchmark made a difference in their performance in higher education. And I am happy to say, in fall of 2001, the first group of students who actually went through our entire system of standards in Oregon for the first time, that was the first year students actually came in to 2- and 4-year institutions. The first question we asked in our study was, how does the performance of students assessed at the 10th grade benchmark level compare with their subsequent performance in college? We knew standards were aligned, so logically, students who perform well on standards should perform well in college. And in fact, that's what we discovered. So the good news about this study is that there are no surprises. If you have over a decade's worth of involvement of schools and two agencies involved in the alignment of standards, one would hope that that standards alignment actually worked for the benefit of students. And that's basically what we found. Let me go more into that, though. You have a chart in front of you. And the chart indicates reading assessment. Now bear with me for a moment. Here's what we did. We looked at the performance of 6,082 students who were first-time freshmen in the Oregon University system. We also looked at the performance of 12,519 students who were first-time freshmen in Oregon's 17 community colleges. For a study of this kind, that is a substantial number upon which to base our findings. So we were very pleased to have that kind of group. Here's what we found. On the reading assessment, what we did was we took that entire group of students. First of all, we'll look at the Oregon University system. And what we did was we spread out the students into five groups, from low, or the bottom 20%, to the top 20%. And here's what we asked. We said, okay, students who come into the Oregon University system who did not pass state assessment in reading, they're in the bottom 20%. How did they do when they came into the system? And what we found is that those students generally had a low C to a high C average. Now, here's something that I think is very interesting to note. Reading is fundamental to college learning. Take a look at the bottom two lines in the graph. Those lines represent science and social studies. So we see in the Oregon University system in the 4 years, in the four-year institutions, students who do not meet state assessment are likely to be at the bottom of what you would recognize and we would all talk about as a C average. So they're at the bottom of a C average, top of a D. That is not a good indicator for continuing college education. Notice the top students who exceed the standard are close to what we would recognize as a B average. On the next slide, you will see community college results. Notice that they are virtually the same. They are virtually the same. Again, let's take a look at the bottom two lines. The bottom two lines indicate reading performance science and social science performance for students who scored in the bottom 20% of the reading assessment. Note, again, those students have a low C average in community college. The second through the fifth quintile are there. Notice how as you do better on state assessment, students perform subsequently better in college. Now that may seem like common sense. However, what it proves is that the Oregon standards are in fact rigorous and that performance at the 10th grade benchmark does provide an early indicator of college success. Isn't it helpful for students to know far enough ahead that they can work on those skill deficits? I'm going to quickly wrap up here. We also looked at the relationship of the 10th grade benchmark assessment to high school GPA and the SAT to first year college performance. The SAT, and when you put the Oregon State assessments together, we combined the Oregon State assessments, the four that were in place at that time, that is writing, reading, math problem solving, and science was a pilot assessment at that time. You know those four assessments as a certificate of initial mastery assessments. We look at actual student performance on benchmarks, not at the entire certificate. We look at the actual performance on benchmarks. And what we learned was that when those tests are combined, that they predict first-year college success at the same level of the SAT. The SAT, of course, occurs later. The Oregon benchmarks, of course, occur at the 10th grade level. Again, an early predictor of college success. By the way, the SAT is not intended as a placement instrument, but is a traditional national measure, and that's why we took a look at it. Finally, we looked at what is the value overall of the state 10th grade benchmark in predicting first-year college performance and success beyond freshman year? Well, first of all, 80% of the students meeting Oregon standards progressed and continued in college beyond the freshman year that we looked at. So in other words, those students came back a second year and registered again. We're going to skip that particular slide and go on to the next because we've been talking about reading. All right, now what does that mean? What that means is that we now have data on actual students and a fair number of them who have gone through our system. And we have very good indicators of students who are likely to be successful and students who are not likely to be successful. So let me explain the slide that you have in front of you. All the way over on the left, notice along the bottom it says C or better. Here's the question. What are your chances of getting a C or better when you go to college? Well, if you met the state benchmark, your chances are 80% of getting a C or better. If you are working toward, that means you're close to meeting, but you're not quite there. If you were working toward the Oregon State benchmark, 10th grade, you would have a 69% chance of getting a C in college. Now, we talked about the notion of a C average in college. Students who tend to be successful and go on to earn their degree in a timely fashion generally leave freshman year with a very high C to a B average coming out of their freshman year, and that puts them in pretty good shape to complete their degree in a timely fashion. All right, if we thought about that, let's take a look at what your chances are of getting a B average. Well, if you meet the same state standard at the 10th grade benchmark, again in reading, you have a 29% chance of getting a B when you go on to college. If you're working toward, you have a 15% chance. If you are low on the 10th grade benchmark in reading, you have less than a 1% chance of getting a B average in college. What are the implications? As Chancellor Jarvis introduced my testimony, the implications are that standards at the 10th grade benchmark are early indicators of college success. What does this mean for kids? What it means is that proactive and informed college advising before the 11th grade, involvement of parents throughout middle school, throughout high school, having the information on student performance and meeting benchmarks will lead, we believe, to more students being prepared to go on to college. We also believe students who had never thought of post-secondary options at all, when informed that they are meeting benchmarks, receive a very different message from us. And that message is, this is a possibility for you. In summary, our next steps are these. One, Oregon University System, community colleges, and the Oregon Department of Education must, and I don't use the word lightly, must complete the development of an integrated data system K-16. For the students of the 20,000 students in our sample, we had to match individual records. The workload issue that you keep hearing about, much of it relates to the lack of an integrated data system so that information can be readily transferred from one sector to another, from the high school, for example, to the community college or the higher ed institution. So that's one of our goals. That system, by the way, is already under development, and we have all made quite a bit of progress. It's a matter of finding the resources in these challenging times to take the next steps we need to do with that. Second, we will continue our partnership with K-12. We have made a very strong commitment to having more students prepared for college. Three, we will continue to study the progress of students. We provide to high schools all over the state a report, an annual performance report, on how their students are doing in higher education. teachers like to know, I worked real hard with my students, what happened to them when they left me? What we were able to tell them this year is not only the grades their students got in higher ed institution, but how their grades related to the standards that they met in high school. This is very powerful. This can only happen because we have aligned standards that directly link together. Finally, we intend to use this data on campuses to inform admissions and placement. Our admissions officers, our advisors, community college advisors are very excited about having data in hand that they can look at to say it looks like students who perform at these levels can do these kinds of things. It looks like we can also more competently advise students on what classes they should take so that they can complete their programs and their degree in a timely fashion. Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity to present to you, and we now welcome your questions.
Representative Hobson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think as Chancellor Jarvis indicated, one of the reasons for looking at this and its predicted value was because of the large number of kids needing remedial classes when they arrived at the system schools. Have you had an opportunity to see if there's any kind of a decrease in the need for those?
Representative Hobson, this study is literally hot off the presses, and we have not had an opportunity to look at remedial rates of those students. However, the data that I just shared with you is consistent across all subject areas, across all types of classes. So in other words, students who perform low tend to earn low grades. The results in remediation are yet to be determined.
Well, thank you very much.
Appreciate it. Thank you for the opportunity.
We're doing the changeover.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, while we're doing the changeover, I'd like to give the committee a notice of next week's meetings. We're going to do a little traveling. On Monday, March 3rd, we'll be conducting a public hearing on House Bill 2415 and House Bill 2744 in hearing room AE at 1 o'clock. On Wednesday, March 5th, we'll be in hearing room E, and the time will be from 5 o'clock p.m. to 7 p.m. Again, on House Bill 2415 and House Bill 2744. And then Thursday, March 6th, we'll be meeting from 5 p.m. to 8 p.m., and this will be at the Wilsonville High School Library in Wilsonville, Oregon. And again, we'll be having public hearings on House Bill 2415 and House Bill 2744, and we have nothing scheduled for Friday.
Any questions? Members? Yes,
sure.
Representative Farr?
Not a question, but that we did talk about. For the rest of the committee, Chair Backlund and Representative Hobson and I will be traveling to Eugene one day the following week, and I believe it's, I wasn't at the 13th maybe, just the three of us. Anybody else is welcome to travel with us, to conduct a similar hearing in Eugene.
Town hall.
It's a town hall, and you can excuse me, not a hearing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, very good. We'll remind everyone on some more frequent occasions as well. There's more often than just once. With that, then, we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2585. Jim, you want to bring us up to date?
Thank you, Chair Backlund. Chair Backlund, committee. House Bill 2585 allows the Oregon Student Assistance Commission to award Oregon Opportunity Grants to students attending a four-year, for-profit institution of higher education in Oregon, whether or not the institution is headquartered in the state. Declares an emergency effective July 1, 2003.
Okay. It looks like we're leading off today with Stephen Kafuri and Pat Hardy. Would that be correct?
That would be correct.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Stephen Kafuri. I'm here today representing two clients, the University of Phoenix and the Art Institute of Portland. Unfortunately, Dr. Goldman from the Art Institute of Portland couldn't be here. Pat Hardy from the University of Phoenix is here with us today. This is a very simple bill. It's somewhat similar to the bill I talked about the other day, having to do with welfare parents and their ability to attend school and still maintain their welfare benefits. The issue in that was whether we ought to be discriminating against those welfare parents who want to go to a for-profit school, and we should require them to go to a not-for-profit school. And the issue we have before us today is the issue of opportunity grants. Personally, I have an aversion to changing names. These used to be called scholarships, and they changed into need grants, and now they're called opportunity grants, which sounds a lot more PC. What they are, of course, is grants rather than scholarships that are given directly to students of very low income so they can continue higher education. This is a simple bill. All it does is redefines which eligible institutions these students can attend and receive these grants from the state. It will eliminate an arbitrary and historically, inaccurate distinction between for-profit and not-for-profit schools. Historically, for-profit schools, post-secondary, have been essentially certificate granting. There have been things like barber and beauty schools, pilot license training, and those kind of things, which were relatively short-term and were focused on a specific set of narrow knowledge and skills. However, in the last few years, we've had the growth, both in the state of Oregon and nationally, of full academic programs run by for-profit schools. Why would a student choose one of these schools rather than a traditional not-for-profit school? Ms. Hardy will talk to you about why students choose the University of Phoenix. I'll talk just briefly about the Art Institute of Portland. It has a curriculum, including computer graphics and commercial design, that is not available in other schools. So if a person wants to get into some of these high-tech fields, some of the commercial design fields, this is the place for them to go. There are in Portland now 1,100 students, 87% of whom are graduates of Oregon high schools attending the Portland Art Institute. The school makes a considerable effort to find graduates in the local economy, and we have success rates achieved above 90% of our students graduating finding jobs immediately. These are students who are entering our economy at a level of high training and education. We know there are more students who would be there if they had financial ability to get there. And this is what the state opportunity grant is all about. You're going to hear some testimony after we get finished about why you should not pass this bill. And what the arguments will be is that there's a limited fund. As you know, our budgets are declining, not increasing, and this is true in the need grant arena as it is true in every other arena of state government these days. They're going to say, therefore, if we have a limited amount of money, we shouldn't add more students to that pot of eligibility. And my rebuttal to that would be that if we had historically a definition between colleges and universities, as we used to have, and said that only students are eligible to go to universities and receive grants, but not at colleges, and now we have virtually no difference between colleges and universities. They're kind of name differences, but don't really reflect much besides that. And we still maintain this distinction. You say, well, that's not fair. Why should students not going to colleges or going to colleges not be eligible when they're going to university? They are eligible. We'd be basing that on an arbitrary distinction. And I think we have the same kind of arbitrary distinction here. Remember, these students are Oregon residents. They're going to Oregon schools. They are Oregon taxpayers. Their parents have been paying taxes. And I think it's time for us to end this arbitrary discrimination. I'll pass out some things from the University of, or excuse me, Art Institute of Portland, and some literature about the University of Phoenix, but I'd like Pat Hardy first to talk about her school.
Thank you, Stephen. Mr. Chairman and committee members, my name is Pat Hardy, and I'm the campus director of the Oregon campus of the University of Phoenix. I'm here today not to represent the University of Phoenix. Rather, I'm here as another advocate for those Oregon citizens who happen to be, or may in the future become, students at our university. In other words, I'm here to make a case that all Oregon citizens should be eligible for state financial aid, regardless of their choice of university. The University of Phoenix was founded in 1975 to serve the educational needs of working adults. The university recognizes that in the United States, our work environment has gradually changed from one of lifelong employment with one employer to one of lifelong learning and employment with a variety of employers. Lifelong learning requires an institution to be dedicated solely to the education of working adults, one which provides the convenience, focus, and quality required by the student and his or her employer. Consequently, the University of Phoenix offers classes in the evenings and weekends when our students are finished with their workday. We locate our campuses in satellite learning centers where the student has a reasonable after-hour commute to class. Our faculty is not only academically qualified, but must possess at least 5 years of practical experience in the working in the field in which they teach. Although the University of Phoenix may be relatively new to Oregon, it's not new to the practice of higher education. The university has been regionally accredited by the Higher Learning Commission North Central Association since 1979. This accrediting agency is the same that accredits academic programs at other universities, for example, Notre Dame or the University of Texas. It's the same standard to which other regionally accredited universities in the state of Oregon are held. The University of Phoenix continues to receive favorable publicity for the quality of its educational offerings, including the television news program 60 Minutes, which has highlighted the high quality of education provided by the university. Our students and alumni also attest to that. The quality and accreditation of the university programs are not all that we have in common with traditional universities. We are not dissimilar as much as we are complementary. We think of our role as one that complements that of traditional universities, which rightfully emphasize continuing education for graduating high school students and those who can afford full-time pursuit of their education. We present a quality education opportunity for those students whose geographical location or work and family schedule preclude other options. As you may know, the University of Phoenix here in Oregon opened its doors to students in 1997 after approval by the Office of Degree Authorization. Our main campus is located in Tigard, and we have established learning centers in Hillsboro, Clackamas, Salem, and Albany. Currently, we have almost 1,600 students enrolled, most of whom are residents of the state of Oregon. We also employ approximately 275 faculty members and an administrative staff of 60 people. Our student recruitment target is the student who is at least 23 years old, employed full-time, and who has some college credit. The average age of our currently enrolled student body is approximately 35 years old. Many of our students are married. Our students state that their reason for selecting the University of Phoenix is that the convenience of our hours and the location allows them the opportunity to complete a degree while fulfilling the demands of full-time employment, family life, and other activities. Many of our undergraduate adult students choose this opportunity to complete an interrupted education begun earlier in life. When I last testified before this committee, approximately 75% of our students received some level of corporate financial assistance from their employers. Now, only 60% do. Then, 20% of our students qualified for Pell Grants. Now, 33% do. For these students, an intense desire to improve their education means stretching their personal financial resources so thinly that they subsequently qualify for federal financial help. Our undergraduates compete for this financial aid on an even footing with all other students in all other academic institutions. That this is not the case with the Oregon Opportunity Grants is unfortunate for them. Eligibility to qualify for these grants might mean the difference between completing their degree or not. For other working adults, an Oregon Opportunity Grant may mean the chance to begin their education again. It is on behalf of these Oregonians that I address my closing remarks. The policy of our legislator on student financial aid is established in statute and provides that the state of Oregon can achieve its full economic and social potential only if all Oregonians have the opportunity to contribute to the full extent of their capabilities, and only when financial barriers to their educational goals are removed. For the University of Phoenix, a for-profit university, the amount contributed to the bottom line by the amount of an Oregon Opportunity Grant is comparatively small. However, for some of our Oregon students, the Opportunity Grant could mean the removal of a financial barrier to full achievement of their full educational, economic, and social potential. That completes my remarks. Thank you for the opportunity.
Yes, Representative Dalton.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I had a question. How does the education and lifelong learning opportunities at the University of Phoenix differ from what's available at public universities and community colleges?
Thank you, Representative Dalton. I believe I can address that when, from a student perspective who comes to us. And though there are adult programs available at state universities and colleges, the convenience of our location and the students go to school one night a week, meet with their learning team one other time a week. So it's really time and convenience and locations. They come to us when they get off work at night. So our locations are situated. We try to make it maybe a 20-minute drive for them from work. Hence, we're in Tigard and Hillsborough and Clackamas. I believe if you ask our 1,600 students, that's what they would say to you. Also, that they are, the average age is 35 years old. They've been working 10 years. They like practitioner faculty teaching their classes. That's very appealing to them.
Mr. Chair,
follow up.
Is it true that in some cases you have University of Phoenix campuses on the campuses of community colleges?
We do. Yes. Yes, we do. We are situated on Lynn Benton, Lynn Benton Community College, and also at Chemeketa. I think certainly the University of Phoenix complements the community college for a student who gets an associate degree and then comes to us with, you know, the age they are.
Thank you.
Representative Vakian.
Thank you for your testimony. The current law would allow a student to get one of these grants that's going to a private nonprofit. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Buckingham, yes, a student under present law could go to Willamette University, Pacific University, the University of Portland, any of the not-for-profit private universities in the state or colleges in the state, and receive a need grant. So they cannot go to the for-profits under the present law.
I'm sure that the reasons for being for-profit or not-for-profit are much greater than this particular issue. But I'm curious about what motivates a school to remain a for-profit school as opposed to trying to get a not-for-profit status in the state.
Hmm. It's interesting. The University of Phoenix was founded by a man named John Sperling, who had been working with the state system in California and had been doing adult education, and found that the system was just too inflexible to do what he wanted to do for adult students. Adult learners are different than 18 to 22-year-olds. They have different needs and different requirements. And so he started a school that was designed for them, and he found that going with for-profit gave him the flexibility in terms of money raising, for one thing, and the ability to operate with the way of the private industry can operate much more flexibly and quickly than the not-for-profit often. And we found he's been extremely successful. The same thing is true of for-profit. There's a motivation for people to, for example, start a new school for art programs because there's a demand out there, and if you can fill that demand with high-quality program and people are willing to pay for it, that's kind of what our American system is all about. And they've been very successful in the state of Oregon. We have a program through the Office of Degree Authorization that is extremely rigorous in regulating both the for-profit and not-for-profit schools so that our standards are uniform and very high quality.
If I may.
Follow up.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for that education, because I don't know much about this area, but I'm What I'm hearing, I guess what I'm hearing you say is that the for-profit status would allow you to raise money privately, which maybe a not-for-profit or public school couldn't do in the same regard, or to roll over certain amounts of money from fiscal year to fiscal year that maybe not-for-profits or public institutions could not do. Is that right?
You're the expert in that area.
Well, I'm not sure that I'm actually the expert in that area, but I do think you. I do think that you are correct.
Okay.
I want to make sure too that you understand that we are regionally accredited, so our accreditation is the same as certainly the University of Oregon, Oregon State. We're accredited through North Central. And that's because our main campus is in Phoenix. When we do have accreditation visits, a representative from the Northwest will also accompany the North Central. So maybe even stricter.
One more, if it's okay, Mr. Chair.
Please follow up.
With any of the money that you are able to raise privately or roll over, do you have within your own institutions any kind of a scholarship program or a grant program that you're able to provide with that type of money?
We do. Through our central administration, we do have scholarship programs available for our students, yes. And that they're available for, we have actually 140,000 students nationwide.
Mr. Chair, Representative Vakian, the same thing is true for the Arden Institute of Portland.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Representative Farr.
A follow-up on the representative. Could you tell me approximately what percentage of your students are on your own grants or your own scholarships?
I do not have that information. I don't. I think our typical student is very different than your typical traditional sure. student. They have to be 23 years old, so they're all working. So it's really a small percentage of our students that we're even talking about who might be eligible for an opportunity grant. These are not 18-year-old high school graduates. These are at least 23 years old. The average age is 35. They've been working for 10 years. So it's really a different makeup.
One more question.
Mm-hmm. Follow up.
Since you're on the same campus as Chemeket and Lynn Benton, can you give me a summary of how your tuition rates compare with the community college's tuition rates?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Farr, I can tell you what I don't know what the community college, I do not know what their tuition rates are. Ours, for a student, all our students are full-time, runs about $8,000 a year for tuition for an undergraduate student.
Mr. Chair, Representative Farr, if I can further answer that question, put it in perspective, I think if you take a look at the private, or excuse me, the public not-for-profit universities, Portland State, Oregon State, you find those are the most inexpensive. Then you put our schools, and then you put the Pacifics, Willamettes, and Reeds at very high expenses. So we follow in between those two extremes of the University of Oregon and the University of Portland.
So significantly higher than community college, then?
Yes, and the four-year University of Portland, or University of Oregon, is considerably higher than Chemeket Community College.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Hobson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Steve, I think you know me well enough. I'm not being argumentative with this, but your use of the word arbitrary got my attention. And I guess I would ask, how would you respond to the concept that we taxpayers, or we the people monitoring the use of tax money, should not be giving to a for-profit educational institution? We don't do it in K-12. Why should we start doing that in higher ed?
I can't think of it, Mr. Chair, Representative Hobson, I can't think of a reason why we would want to discriminate between a for-profit and a not-for-profit, with the qualifying differences that a student who goes to Willamette versus a student who goes to the University of Phoenix. To me, it is arbitrary. And if someone can make a characterization between a student who goes to one school and a student who goes to another school, it baffles me. The money is going to the student, and the student is going to a higher education institution that meets that student's need. I can't think of why there would be a difference.
If I may piggyback on that question.
Yes, Representative Vaki.
If you were done, Representative.
I am. Yeah.
One might argue that as a for-profit corporation, your greater flexibility in fundraising or rollover gives you an advantage in offering students access to your schools that a not-for-profit or a public institution might not be able to provide. And I'm wondering if that in some way relates to Representative Hobson's question you might want to respond to.
Mr. Chair, Representative Vaki, there's enormous differences between the types of schools and the types of programs that we have in the state of Oregon in which students can. There are some that are extremely traditional, and there are some that are extremely experimental or on the more liberal side of the programs. I'd hate to take a look and say this kind of school is operated this kind of way in categorizing them. I don't know how much you can.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Nolan.
If I might switch gears a little bit. You're a for-profit institution. How much profit did you make last year?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nolan, I'm the campus director of the Oregon campus, and I have no idea how much the University of Phoenix made last year. I honestly have no idea. I can say from our campus, I don't have those figures in front of me, but I can certainly get them to you. But as far as the University of Phoenix goes, I believe, we have a fact book, and I can send that out to you.
Thanks. I would appreciate that. A follow-up?
Follow-up.
If we're adding to the list, you may know the answer to this. You may have to add it to the list of things you need to get. I assume that the way you raise money is by selling stock. And if, under that assumption, I'd be interested in knowing what your stock price is, how your stock price has performed over the last 5 years.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nolan, as I just answered Mr. Vaki, there's a lot of difference among the different schools. The University of Phoenix stock, I can say when I first joined this institution, I was brought down to the University of Phoenix. This is before we came on campus, so it's 7 years ago or so. I went down to the Phoenix campus and got oriented to the school, and I was so extraordinarily impressed by the operation of that institution. The first break, I went out into the courtyard and called my broker on his cell phone. I said, buy me some stock. And that stock has gone up more than 10 times in those years. But it's an extremely successful operation. It takes a market that has been, it's huge, the working adult, and it has targeted a program for that working student in a way that nobody else has. And it's been extremely successful at it. It's highly competitive now. The University of Phoenix stepped into this game early. And as soon as we did, a lot of other schools have done this. There's a number of schools here in the state of Oregon that are modeling themselves after this product that we have. And so there is price competition. It's not that they're charging lots and lots of money and ripping off students. It's a very competitive game right now. We have the issue of the universities having the public universities having their adult education programs modeling in some ways after the University of Phoenix programs. And we also have the George Fox's and Merrill Hurst of the state not-for-profits also starting up these kind of programs. So there's considerable price competition. The reason we're making money is not because we're charging a lot of money. The reason we're making money is because we're running a very high-quality product that's increasingly in demand. We've grown from a very small institution to the largest university in the world in how many states now?
27
states. The growth is phenomenal. The PE is pretty high, too, so this shows you it's not an extraordinarily high profit, making it, looking down the line with the growth.
Thanks.
Representative Dalton.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kafouri, is it your understanding that the Oregon Opportunity Grant pool of money is a finite pool?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dalto, I hope it's not a diminishing. I don't know what this legislature is going to have to do, but every other budget I've seen for whatever, the people seeing behind me for the state system of higher education that are going to have, I'm sure, are going to be not happy with what the 2003 legislature ends up with. Yes, right now it's a diminishing pool for everything.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
So, in a sense, are students of the University of Phoenix, if they were granted this Oregon Opportunity Grant, the ability to obtain this grant, would they be competing against students that are attending public colleges and community colleges?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dalto, exactly. Just the same as the students at Reed College are competing against and the students at Temecula Community College. They're all competing against each other for a limited pot of money. It's a much too small number of dollars that are available, no question about it.
Except in the examples that you bring up, those aren't companies that are taking the bottom line to another state. I don't know if that's a question, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Representative Hobson?
Thank you. Could you tell me how many other schools, I realize you're representing Portland Art Institute in Phoenix, how many other schools would be involved here in the state?
I had my associate, Mr. Chair, Representative Hobson, I had my associate run this information for me down. I'm sorry you don't have it. There are a handful, five or six. I can't tell you off the top of my head.
That's good. Thanks.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. We have Melissa Unger, and is that Julie Sajchenik, and Grant and Karen, you're coming up together, or?
It's okay.
Two of you? Okay.
Chair Backlund, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Melissa Unger, and I represent the Oregon Student Association as their legislative director. The Oregon Student Association represents students at all seven public universities, OHSU, and Lane Community College. And we oppose this bill, House Bill 2585. Oregon cannot afford this bill. Access to Oregon's universities is already severely limited. Tuition at our 2- and 4-year colleges is among the highest in the West. The Oregon Opportunity Grant is already severely underfunded, and we have no additional aid for student parents. And House Bill 2585 will only make the problem worse. By adding students attending for-profit institutions, we're going to be making the pool of students trying to receive the Oregon Opportunity Grant larger. Already, the Oregon Student Assistance Commission for 2003-2005 estimates that 53% of eligible students will receive the grant, meaning that 24,000 eligible students will not be able to receive this grant who are currently attending our universities. Because of changes in eligibility requirements, students who currently receive this grant this year and next year, have received this grant for the entire college experience, will not receive this grant next year. So students who have been expecting $1,200 every year since they were a freshman in college will be $1,200 short. By adding more people to the grant, we will only be thinning the pool. Obviously, we don't have enough money. We can't afford this bill. It will only limit access to higher education. Oregon received an F in affordability in a report released in October 2002. We just received national attention for making the most cuts to higher education. We cannot afford to pass House Bill 2585. The students across Oregon ask you, urge you to vote to oppose House Bill 2585. And I can answer any questions and if you have any for me.
Okay, continue.
Chair Backlund and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Julie Sahonik, and I represent the Oregon Community College Association, which represents the 17 community colleges in Oregon and over 400,000 students that they serve. The Oregon Community College Association opposes House Bill 2585 for three primary reasons. The first reason is that House Bill 2585 would expand the pool of eligible students at a time when they're when there's not enough state funding to serve the current population that's currently served by the Oregon Opportunity Grant. Currently, this year alone, 13,000 eligible students are going unserved due to a lack of funding, and as Melissa mentioned to you earlier, that number is likely to go to 24,000 next year. In addition, secondly, the high cost of education associated with for-profits would place a fiscal constraint on the award size for students currently served by the Oregon Opportunity Grant. The award sizes for the Oregon Opportunity Grant are based on the cost of education. The cost per credit hour at the University of Phoenix is $325 and $329 at the Art Institute of Portland. This is nearly seven times the cost per credit hour at a community college, which is $46.90, and nearly four times the cost per credit hour at an OUS institution, which is $81 per credit hour for the 16 credit hours, which is the average amount that a full-time student would take there. And finally, we say that at a time when Oregon's community colleges and universities are facing fiscal constraints because of the fiscal crisis here in the state of Oregon, we think that any money that is spent or used should stay in Oregon and should not be given the option to be sent to institutions that are headquartered out of the state of Oregon. I thank you for this opportunity, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to take those.
Mr.
Yes, Representative Farr?
Just to make sure I got the numbers down right. At a community college in the state of Oregon, it's $46 per credit hour?
$46.90.
And 90 cents. Okay. That must be the profit. Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for the record, Grattan Cairns, Director of Government Relations for the Oregon University System. Melissa and Julie have done an excellent job framing the issue for you. We want to join with them on behalf of the university system and the students enrolled and those who will seek access in the future that you set the bill aside. Clearly, it is a lifeboat issue which you're being asked to determine. You add people to the pool, you must put someone out of the lifeboat. We believe that you ought to recognize that you have a good policy reason for directing the opportunity grant to Oregon resident students at public and not-for-profit institutions, and hold fast to that policy and to the students you are now serving, and not displace them for someone who is attending a school which has access to equity markets and, as has been alluded to in the questions from the committee, the ability to provide a profit to those who go to the equity market to share in the benefit of that ownership. One that we don't have, and one which we think it would be difficult for us to defend as a matter of policy. We are in a place today in Oregon that I have never seen. I first came into this building now some 31 years ago. I have never seen a budget in the condition that this one is in now, and I've never seen Oregon retreat as dramatically as we have from those who are seeking a public post-secondary educational experience. At the same time we're doing that, we are withdrawing rapidly from the support that we are directing to those who have economic need and need assistance with an opportunity grant. Never before in my experience have I seen this kind of a condition. I would urge that we stand fast with the policy you have adopted in the past, and then also see what we can do about directing assistance to those students who are seeking admission to your public and not-for-profit institutions, community colleges and four-year, in order to assist them to get an educational experience and renew Oregon in the future. We've had one already very injurious occurrence here when ballot measure 19 was adopted in September, withdrew dollars from the opportunity grant fund. It was collateral damage and may occur again with legislation now before this legislature. At a time when that pool is shrinking so rapidly, this is not a time to go and say, let us either dilute the grant or put somebody out of the lifeboat. We have to be opposed.
Okay.
Well, thank you. I've got one.
Well, excuse me. Representative,
I wasn't clear. I'm sorry about that. Mr. Cairns, I'm guessing that you don't have any objection to private institutions like Willamette continuing to make use of the grant.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Vakian, no. That's a policy decision which the legislature has made in the past. It's a longstanding one, and one which all of us have acknowledged.
Could you then be a little bit more specific about what your objection is to a private school which happens to carry a profit as opposed to one that doesn't?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Vakian, that is a policy choice, which I said is for the committee. You can set a new policy parameter and say that for those who have access to the equity market, acknowledging the fact that they have access to the equity market and acknowledging that profits generated in-state are paid as dividends to those shareholders across the world, that notwithstanding, you may, by law, set that new policy. And I'm not objecting to that on behalf of the Oregon University system. I am telling you that for our students, we have a practical issue, and that is bringing more people to a shrinking pie means either smaller slices or no slices for some who now have a slice. And that's the kind of, we're really talking about budgetary triage here, and I'm asking you not to make it harder.
Well, certainly we could create whatever policy we thought was most appropriate, but I'm guessing because you brought up the issue of their ability to gain equity and invest money and such, that you see that as a concern and as a distinction that we should not make, and I'm curious why.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Avakian, let me be very clear. That is not a policy issue which the State Board of Higher Education or I would come here and advance to you. I'm recognizing the fact that it's already been alluded to here in your own questions to the previous witnesses, and reporting back to you that that is a policy issue that you would have to overcome or acquiesce in order to then get to the problem that I'm bringing to you, and that is more people to a shrinking resource.
I understand. Well, just one more. Thank you.
Follow up.
Mm-hmm. Given what you have described so well, the struggles that we're facing in public education today anyway with a shrinking budget, including this particular one, why should we not move to a policy that enables more freedom for students to go to a private institution if that's what they choose to do, where they might find greater security than they do in the public system? Why would that be a poor policy decision for us?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I won't describe it as either good or poor or good. That's a policy decision which the committee and the legislature and the governor have before them. I'm here simply reporting to you on behalf of the students that attend universities that I represent and saying that in the present circumstance, we're forced to, in effect, economically deny access to people who could get an affordable education at one of the system's seven campuses or at the 17 community colleges and use those resources elsewhere. We think that it is probably a mistake to deny access or simply dilute the value for everybody in the pool. I hope that was responsive.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Farr.
Just wanted to make sure that I have the whole tuition thing clear in my mind. If somebody were going full-time to a community college, it would be, 45 credit hours per year? Is that correct?
I believe so.
Three
yeah.
times 15? Okay. Okay, and I did a little bit of math, and I understand that it's $8,000 a year for University of Phoenix, which if you divide that by the 325 number, that works out to be 24... approximately 24 credits. Are they a different kind of credit?
Chair Backlund, Representative Farr, I'm not sure how they define their credit per hour. When I called the University of Phoenix to find out their information, that's the figure I was given, and then the Art Institute of Portland has the breakdown per credit hour at 325. So that may be a question to ask the representative from the University of Phoenix, how they define their credit hour.
Okay. Well, I would like to be clear on that as we go forward with this decision, because at $47, if you're running approximately 50 credit hours, that's $2,350 a year, something like that. So that brings it a little bit closer to the 8,000. I mean, it's no longer seven times greater. But could I have an explanation as to why 24 credit hours consists of a year? Yeah.
Please come up. Yes.
Okay, that's what I thought.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Farr.
Pat, would you reintroduce yourself for the record?
Yeah. Thank you. For the record, my name is Pat Hardy. I'm the campus director of the University of Phoenix. Your question about our tuition, we are a semester. I believe the community college is quarter. They operate four quarters a year or two semesters.
Okay, that explains it. Thanks very much.
Great.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, if one of the previous three could come up, I had a question. We all know that ballot measure 19 did withdraw some money from the opportunity grant, in effect. Do you recall, Grattan, what that amount was?
$3.5 million, I believe.
So that is the real dilemma, of course, where the less money, obviously, has been alluded to many times. This is a specific amount, less than what had been determined as of the 2001 legislative session.
Mr. Chairman,
now with our current economic situation, it could diminish further.
Mr. Chairman, yes, that's correct, and there is legislation being considered, I believe, this week, which if the figure, there's a blank in the bill, so we don't know what would be taken. But if the numbers I see in the newspaper are correct, then the opportunity grant could take a hit of up to $3.7 million in addition to that, plus the $2 million which has been withdrawn as a result of special session action and allotment control actions in this last academic year. So at this point, you're talking about $9.2 million, which has come out of a program with an $18 million annual budget. And that's the level at which you're going to go forward in the next year, the 50% reduction level, and then someone's coming to you and asking to please slice the pie even thinner, or keep someone from having a slice who has one now. Those are triage issues that are really lifeboat issues, and that's our message to you.
Mr. Chair?
Oh, yes, Representative Nolan.
Well, Mr. Cairns is here. Unless I see Debbie Murdoch in the room, although she's not on the witness list. So, Mr. Cairns, I'll pop this question to you, and you can defer it to her if it isn't germane to the entire system. I just know Portland State because it's in my district, and I know that they are working at changing some of their course scheduling plans, and I know that their average age of students is increasing, and that their population that their programs are serving more and more of the need that we heard discussed by the University of Phoenix. And I wanted to know if you could either comment briefly on that, perhaps for the whole system, and what universities in the system are doing to address some of the needs for working adults.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nolan, I can speak to the system as a whole, and if others wish to come forward, you want to direct other questions to a specific campus represented in the room today, I'm sure they'd be happy to respond. The average age across the university system is about 27 years of age. The non-typical student is the 18-year-old who comes out of high school and prepares to go through and graduate before their 22nd birthday. We have an awful lot of folks who have returned. We have people who are coming back for advanced degree. We have people who have coming for the first time. In addition, we are, of course, more and more getting into the virtual world with dozens and dozens of degree programs available in non-traditional, either web or other access opportunities, weekend college, those sorts of programs that address the non-traditional student. So, in that regard, we have a pretty broad mix of students ourselves, and it's even, of course, even much more broad when you go to the community college and look at their mm-hmm. student population. Was that responsive?
Thanks, and I that's fine. I don't know that we need the specifics from Portland State. It's just that I'm familiar with their programs. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Rob Wagner and Rich Peppers. Rich was here, but he's not at this point, I see.
I'm kind of picking up the slack for Rich. He actually just had another meeting that he had to go to. But for the record, Rob Wagner with the American Federation of Teachers, Oregon. Just briefly, I think you've kind of heard the broad outline of some of the arguments. I just wanted to get on the record who we are and our opposition to House Bill 2585. We represent over 5,000 faculty and classified staff at community colleges and OUS campuses across the state, from Newport to LaGrand, Portland, Eugene, Coos Bay. Just briefly, we've been opposed to this bill. We've seen it in previous iterations and prior legislative sessions as well. Echoing some of the testimony you've heard, in these times of financial crisis, our members oppose pulling dollars, whether directly or indirectly, out of state institutions, which are experiencing what we call a triple squeeze of increased demand, reduced state support, and then more specifically, the depletion of grant funding for real high-need students. And then just finally, as a final note, this last Friday, the governor and the state of the state promoted the Brand Oregon initiative, which basically said shop Oregon first. And we oppose shifting tax dollars to for-profit institutions who set up whose shareholders live out of state and who set up shop out of state as well. And keeping dollars locally to boost Oregon's economy makes a lot more sense, especially given the financial times that we're in. And then just as one real brief final note, it's like to comment on the proponent's excellent testimony. In some sense, I think actually cuts the argument out for the need for this bill. If their stock was able to increase 10 times in the last 7 years, and they've seen this massive expansion, I'm wondering the need for state aid at this time, and maybe we could return some of those dollars to grants to provide some access to students who might really be in need of those services. So that's my only comment. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Before I name our last person who signed up to testify, I did want to apologize publicly to Julie, whose last name I botched very badly. Sorry about that. Anyway, we also have Jeff, and now I'll need some help on that last name.
For the record, my name is Jeff Sweetser. I'm with the Oregon Student Assistance Commission. I'm the executive director. And first off, I would like to say I wish I had a magic wand, because when I look at our mission is to serve students, and we do not look at where they go. What we are interested in is a student getting a quality education to be able to achieve their goals and also the goals of the state. I just want to say that I'm impressed with the speakers that were for this bill. I think it's a credit to, not only to them, but their institutions that they represent. But the reality is that there is currently not enough funding to go around to serve the low-income students who currently qualify for the program. And some of the prior speakers have mentioned this. But I just wanted to say that in this upcoming year, we are projecting there's going to be 54,000 low-income Oregonians who are going to qualify for this grant. We have enough money to serve about 30,000 of them. So there's 24,000 students who are currently going to community colleges, private and public, not-for-profit institutions, who are not going to be receiving this grant. And the picture gets bleaker as we look out. The testimony about the PASS system, talking about how the numbers of students that are going on to post-secondary education are increasing, so are the number of low-income Oregonians who are attempting to access an education. In 04, 05, we're looking at that number of eligible students being increased to about 58,000. And again, splitting the biennium into two, we're still serving 30,000 of those. So we are approaching serving only half of the students who qualify for the grant. I'm standing here in the shoes of a seven-member commission. I don't have a position on this bill. That's why I signed it as neutral, because I've not had the opportunity of discussing it with them. However, I will share with you that in the development of our agency's budget, in discussions about the Oregon Opportunity Grant Program, we did have discussions about who was eligible, and the discussion about private for-profit schools came up. We also took a look at did we want to include serving part-time students, because this grant only serves students who are enrolled full-time. And the conclusion of the commission, at the time that we developed our budget, they identified three priorities, and there is some long-standing history about these priorities. There are three of them, and the first one was to fund all who qualify currently for the Oregon Opportunity Grant Program. The second criteria was to increase the amount of the award that each student who qualified received so that they could eliminate the unmet need. And we did a study this past year that took a look at the Oregon Opportunity Grant, who it served, how much, how effective it was. And in the sample that we looked at of 2,000 individuals, there was about $4,000 of unmet need. It takes X number of dollars, and you only had Y to go to school. That's after taking into consideration federal aid, the Oregon Opportunity Grant, what the families could contribute to their cost of education. There's still a $4,000 gap. So the second goal was to increase that grant size to minimize that. And then the third criteria was we have two different populations that we look at: independent students who are normally 24 years of age or older, and dependents who are, I think, most people's perception of the 18-year-old student getting out of high school, going on to college. We have two different income thresholds, and we wanted to equalize that. What's interesting is in preparing for our budget presentations, which was supposed to be start today, the commission looked at the financial situation that the state is in, took a look at the number of students who are attempting to go on to college, and we realized that in order to do our part, we had to really take a look at how we could stretch those dollars. So we took a pool of applicants and actually modified our eligibility criteria to shrink the pool of people who qualified for this grant. So we're actually going in the wrong direction as far as being able to serve the existing populations. So given the priorities of the commission and the state's current financial situation, the commission doesn't recommend approving additional schools or students at this time.
Okay, thank you very much, Jeff. Would anyone in the audience like to testify? We do have a bit of time. Okay. Seeing that there are none, then with that, we will adjourn the meeting, and we will close the public session. Public hearing, on House Bill 2585.